Hey, everybody. Welcome. I'm Patricia Lynch. I'm the executive director here at the Music Hall and the creator and executive producer for Writers on a New England Stage. And it is great to have all of you here. Now, tonight, we're going to welcome the celebrated author Greg Mortensen. His book, Three Cups of Tea, has been a fixture on the New York Times bestseller list for more than 3 years. Mr. Mortensen is a true humanitarian. He's also a former mountaineer and co-founder of the nonprofit Central Asia Institute. Mr. Mortensen is here to discuss his latest work, Stones into Schools. This dramatic first-person narrative picks up where Three Cups of Tea left off in 2003, recounting his tireless ongoing efforts to establish schools in the secluded northeast corner of Afghanistan. As did Three Cups of Tea, it follows another of Mortensen's promises and the work of the Central Asian Institute to launch schools into the heart of Taliban country. Also on the job at moments, Mortensen has helped the U.S. military formulate new strategic plans in the region. This evening, Mr. Mortensen will be making a 25-minute presentation complete with pictures. After that, he's going to be interviewed by Laura Canoy, host of New Hampshire Public Radio's award-winning call-in program, The Exchange. Now, Laura Canoy is a radio veteran who's worked as a newscaster and reporter for National Public Radio and many other radio outlets. She was, in 2007, she was named New Hampshire's Broadcaster of the Year. For the last 14 years, she's been the host of The Exchange, New Hampshire's only statewide call-in radio show. Throughout the coming hour, as we get to know Greg Mortensen and his work, our house band Dreadnought, once again, they were just terrific, we'll be playing Greg Mortensen theme music. Now, if you have a question you'd like Laura to ask Greg Mortensen during her interview, would you please just jot it down on the index cards that we've handed out? We're going to try to answer as many as we have time for. Now, those of us who work on Writers on a New England Stage, we're committed to bringing you the best, most thought-provoking new literature and celebrating the life of the mind. Since the series partnership launch in 2005, we've been a triumvirate of partners. The Music Hall and New Hampshire Public Radio, working in collaboration with Portsmouth's independent River Run Bookstore. Together, we've introduced Music Hall audiences and New Hampshire Public Radio listeners to nearly 24 writers. The series has been a real success, and for us and our visiting authors, it struck a chord, and the media has begun to take note. Now, I have an announcement to make. One national print publication in particular has stepped forward to salute the series and lend its support. We've gained, as a partner, Yankee Magazine. They're based across the state in Dublin, New Hampshire, but in touch with 2 million print readers and more online. Starting immediately, they'll be promoting the series to their readers and building us a home on their website. It's a partnership we're all excited about. Here tonight, and could you please stand, our president and CEO, Jamie Trowbridge. There he is. Editor Mel Allen. And communications manager Heather Atwell. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. Now, and they brought with them the latest issue of Yankee Magazine as a gift. We look forward to many great writers' nights ahead. Now, tonight, we also want to welcome and thank the many school groups that we have in the audience, as well as book clubs. Also, there are volunteers here for Passport to Peace and Pennies for Peace. And they're building awareness and fundraising for Greg Mortensen's national organization, the Central Asia Institute. And there's a publication that you have and that they'll be able to talk to you about. This is the central publication for the Central Asia Institute, and we hope you'll take a moment to look at it. And they'll also be near the entrance lobby for you to talk to them in person. Now, I'd like to acknowledge our sponsors, and please, can you hold your applause, because I want to get through this list. And tonight, our evening sponsor, and I welcome them most particularly, is Measured Progress. And our series sponsor is OJ Building Company, Inc., Calypso Communications, New England Audio Tech, Piscataqua Landscaping Company, RMC Research Corp., Haunted Milk Design, and Popovers and Galley Hatch Hospitality Group. And New Hampshire Public Radio would like to thank their sponsor this evening, Heinemann. So let's all give them a nice thanks. But I want to take a particular shout out to the members of the Music Hall and New Hampshire Public Radio, because you know we couldn't do programs like this without you. So thank you. Now, Writers on a New England Stage with Greg Mortensen is going to air on The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio on Wednesday, December 9th. So if you have friends and family that weren't able to make it to either of these shows, you tell them to tune in there, would you? All right, now tonight, now about Greg Mortensen's book. Backstage this afternoon, Mr. Mortensen signed copies of Stones Into School for those in the audience who bought book vouchers in advance through the Music Hall and River Run Bookstore. Lucky you, you've gotten that 10% discount, that gift back from the Music Hall and River Run. If you have a voucher and want to pick up your book, you will go downstairs and there will be book voucher tables that you can exchange your book voucher for the books following this show. Or there should be a book table in the upper lobby as well. Now remember, a signed book is a great addition to any reader's library, and this being the Christmas season, I can't imagine a more thoughtful gift than Stones Into Schools. Please, in the spirit of shop local, buy your books for Writers on a New England Stage, either here at the Music Hall or at River Run Bookstore. We so appreciate it, and it's important to this series. Now back to tonight. I have a couple of favors. If you've got any of those jingly jangling, beepity boppity things, I think they're called cell phones, would you turn them off? Okay, thanks. All right, and please, no photographs, all right? I appreciate that. Now, if you will join me in welcoming to the stage Greg Mortensen.
Thank you very much. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Again, I'd like to thank the Music Hall and New Hampshire Public Radio. And we had a little cheer when we came across the border here from the other state next door. So, and to River Run Bookstore, we're working very hard for several weeks. I'd like to thank everybody from River Run Bookstore. They're running around in the back there. Also, Patricia Lynch, and I noticed Patricia, when she came up here, she had on cowboy boots. I'm from Montana, so I guess I wear a few cowboy boots out here. And thank you to Laura, who will be doing the interview later this evening. And also, special thanks to the Dreadnought Band for their music before we started this evening. I'd also like to thank all the places of worship, the veterans, the AUW, the women's book clubs, and the many different organizations that have helped out and who've participated. It's such an honor to be with you here this evening. I recently came back from Afghanistan, and just so you, I'd just like to tell you that I picked up something called viral pericarditis. It's a virus I have around my heart, and it's not contagious, but my oxygen saturation is a little low, so if I look a little squirmy or I start, getting a little squirmy, don't worry about it. Everything's fine. How many of you read Three Cups of Tea? Okay, wow. So maybe we shouldn't even talk about that. But when I picked the title of the book in honor of Haji Ali, village chief, who told me that if you do business here, you need three cups of tea, and he said that the first cup, you're a stranger, second cup, a guest, and third cup, you become family. And for a family, we were prepared to do anything, even die. But the publisher picked the subtitle, and they said it, they wanted it to be One Man's Mission to Fight Terrorism One School at a Time. And although I'm a military veteran, I was opposed to that because I say the real reason I do this is about education and peace. Well, they disagreed with me, so finally I went to New York, and they summoned a Jurgis, like a tribal conference. And the CEO and head of marketing and head of publicity, and I tried to very eloquently state why I want the subtitle of the book to be One Man's Mission to Promote Peace One School at a Time. Well, when I got done, they said, you know, we understand what you're trying to say, but this is your first book, son, and you need to learn a couple things about the publishing industry. Only 1 out of 8 nonfiction books makes a profit, and 2/3 of all bestsellers are pre-chosen by the publisher. So we'd like to promote this book, but you need to be fighting terrorism so you can pitch the media, and then your book could do well. Well, finally, I conceded, but if you work in Afghanistan or Pakistan or even, you know, here probably in New Hampshire, you never settle a deal without driving a hard bargain on the side. So I said, if the hardcover doesn't do well, I'd like the paperback subtitle changed. So anyways, the hardcover came out in 2006, and for a year it didn't do very well. 1 year later, they changed the subtitle to One Man's Mission to Promote Peace, One School at a Time, and now it's been a New York Times bestseller for 144 weeks in a row. I also have had the honor, the last couple years, I've received hundreds of letters from people serving in the military. I voluntarily visit about 24 military bases a year to help our troops going over to Afghanistan. 3 cups of tea also now is a mandatory reading for all senior officers in the U.S. military. It's also... mandatory reading for special forces deploying to Afghanistan. General Petraeus, who's the CENTCOM commander, read 3 cups of tea last year, and he sent me an email. He said that he had 3 points that he had gleaned from the book that he'd like to impart with the troops. And being a military general, he summarized them in 3 bullet points. And number one, he said that we need to listen more. Number two, we need to build relationships. And number three, that we have to have respect, meaning we are there to serve the good people there. Well, I grew up in East Africa for 14 years, and it was a great place to grow up. I got to go to school with children from many countries, and Muslims, and Jews, and Christians, and Hindus. And my father ended up starting a hospital called the Kilimanjaro Christian Medical Center. There you are. And my father worked very hard to get the hospital started. And one thing he always insisted on was having local people in charge. And that sometimes didn't go over very well with the Westerners, because they said you need a qualified Westerner to run the hospital. And finally, the hospital opened up in 1971. And my father got up and gave a little speech. And he said that he had a prediction to make that in 10 years, all the department heads of the hospital would be from Tanzania. And basically, he got laid off for saying that later on, because he had the audacity to believe that the people themselves could run the hospital, and they'd come from the country. Well, we came back to the States, and unfortunately, my father died from cancer in his mid-40s in 1980. But we got the annual report 10 years later, and all the department heads were from Tanzania. And even today, 38 years later, all the department heads of the Kilimanjaro Christian Medical Center are from Tanzania. One thing that I learned as a child in Africa, a very beautiful proverb, and it says that if we educate a boy, we educate an individual. But if we can educate a girl, we educate a community. So how do the gentlemen feel about that? Okay, well, pretty good. I think that's the most hefty applause I've heard. Now, how do the women feel about it? I think... gentlemen, we're a little bit outnumbered here, but anyhow. I came back to the States when I turned 15. Although this is, you can see this is a little predated here. Anybody have a picture of St. Paul High School, I'd appreciate it. My first day in high school, though, in St. Paul, Minnesota, I got beat up. The kids, it was because I made a mistake. I said I'm African. There was some confusion about that. You know, actually, it was the first time in my life they learned what the word racism was. It wasn't in Africa, it was here in the U.S. We were quite poor, so 4 days after high school, in June of 75, I did something very unpopular at the time. This is right after the Vietnam War, I joined the U.S. Army. And I did it for 2 reasons. I wanted to serve my country, and I wanted to get the GI Bill so I could go to university. And it was actually in the military where I met young men and women from all across the U.S. and made me appreciate that we are a great country, not because of our commonality, but because of our great diversity. As those of you who read Three Cups of Tea know, it starts out with my younger sister, Krista. And Krista was very special, but it was because she suffered from severe epilepsy. She never complained. She also spent a couple hours the night before school. She'd get her clothes lined up and pack her lunch and get her bags ready. I'm kind of the five-minute bed-to-bus kind of guy. Anyhow, in 1992, Krista saw the baseball movie called Field of Dreams. So she was going to go from the Twin Cities down to Dyersville, Iowa, to see where the movie was filmed. And she packed her bags. But when my mother went to wake up Krista, July 24th, 1992, Krista died in her sleep from a massive seizure. So I decided at the time to climb K2, the world's second highest mountain, and put an amber necklace on the top of the mountain in honor of my sister Krista. I finally went to K2 in 93. This is the highest, greatest consolidation of high peaks in the world. There are 64 peaks above 23,000 feet high in a 100-mile area. Here's K2. The first attempt was 100 years ago, 1909, the Duke of Abruzzi, an Italian gentleman. He also was quite a gentleman because he wore a tweed jacket and a tie eating Kansas sardines. He went up the right side of the mountain there. This is an avalanche. If you look very closely in the right-hand foreground, you can see four little blue tents. And if you had a magnifying glass, you can see four Spanish men in their underwear running out of the tents. Unfortunately, nobody is killed in this avalanche. Here we are working our way up the West Ridge. On the left-hand side is China, on the right-hand side is Pakistan. And finally, 78 days later, it was time to go home. I was very weak, exhausted, but most of all, I felt as if I'd let my sister down. So those of you who read Three Cups of Tea, can anybody here remember what the first chapter is called? Without cheating here. Who said that? Who said that? Give her a big round. She said the word failure. Very good, failure. And when I submitted the original manuscript to New York, they said, Greg, in the U.S., you never start a book with the word failure. But you know what? We all make mistakes, and we all fail. Some of us fail in our relationships. Some of us burn cookies in the oven. Some of us don't do too well in school. I was on Wall Street in January, and I mentioned that some of us fail in our investments, and nobody laughed there. Anyways, so the next time you fail, think this very beautiful Persian proverb that says, when it is dark, you can see the stars. Well, I worked my way off the mountain. I stumbled into a little village called Corfe, and I recovered there. And one day I walked behind the village. I saw 84 children sitting in the dirt during their school lessons, 5 girls, 79 boys, and most of the kids were riding with a stick in the sand. And although I'd seen a lot of poverty in Africa, when I saw those kids, they really touched my spirit. And so I told them I'd help them build a school. And for those of you, what grade are you in? 5th grade? Okay. You know, the kids, they didn't even have a teacher there. And I looked around, I said, you know, like, where's your teacher? You're in a school. And they said, well, our teacher, Master Sainz, is in the next village because we can't afford his daily $1 salary. So he split his time 3 days a week with another school. Can you imagine if your teacher only showed up 3 days a week? Would you still be coming to school? Maybe, okay. Or did you say no? She said no, but I said maybe, okay. All right. I just want to make sure your teacher's not in the audience. Okay. So I made a promise to build a school. I had to raise $12,000. I came back to the States, and I've gotten a lot of flack for this, but I had no clue how to fundraise. So what I did is I went to the local library. Are there any librarians in here? Okay, give them all a big round. There you go. All right. I like that. New Hampshire librarians put their hand up very high. Most librarians kind of go like this. So that's really great. Thank you. And librarians and teachers are my heroes. So we looked up the name of 580 celebrities and movie stars, and so I hand-typed 580 letters. Dear Michael Jordan, dear Sylvester Stallone, and guess what happened? Nothing happened. And finally, at Christmas time, I got one check back from Tom Brokaw, the newscaster. Now, Tom has recently moved to Montana, and he's been a big help with Three Cups of Tea, but he also is kind of avoiding me lately. So he had us to his ranch for dinner one night recently, and I asked him, I said, Tom, you know, why are you avoiding me lately? He said, well, Greg, I'm kind of embarrassed because everywhere I go in airports and other places, people pull me aside and ask about this three cups of tea thing, and I'm really embarrassed because I wrote you a $100 check and you wrote about it and put it in the book. You know, I didn't quite have the guts to say, you know, Tom, you can still write another check and we'll stick it in the next book. Anyhow, but he did inspire lots of people. So then I sold my car, I sold my climbing gear. I was also working double shifts many months in a row to raise money for the school. And by springtime, I'd only raised just over $3,000. And I then was invited by my mother to an elementary school in Wisconsin called Westside, and it's in River Falls, Wisconsin. And you know, it was the first time I'd ever spoken to anybody about my goal to build a school. And I was quite nervous, and you know, heaven forbid I go to elementary school to raise any money. But when I got down, though, there was a fourth grader. His name was Jeffrey. And he came up to me, looked at me deadpan, and he said, "I've got a piggy bank at home, and I'm going to help you." And I didn't think anything of it. But 6 weeks later, Westside School had raised 62,340 pennies. And really, that was what started this out. And I would not be here had not been for those pennies. So we have a program today called Pennies for Peace. And the program, we incorporate a lot of things in it. One thing, I visit about 200 schools a year around the U.S. and public, private schools, urban schools, rural schools. You know, all the way from kindergarten to the Air Force Academy. And the first thing I ask students is, how many of you have talked in great detail to your grandparents about the Depression or World War II or the Vietnam War or the Civil Rights Movement? And generally in the U.S., only 10% of the hands come up. Very consistent. It doesn't matter whether it's a public or a private school. If I ask the same exact question in Pakistan or Afghanistan, 90 or 100% of the hands come up. And I really think that's one of the great tragedies of our country, that we've lost a tradition where we can learn from our elders. It's about our folklore, our heritage, our culture, and many of the important things that we glean in history. And that's one thing that I had hoped that we could, maybe if it's not happening in our homes, maybe we could also bring it into our schools so that our children could learn about those very important traditional values. So also with Pennies for Peace, we encourage kids to do things on their own. And it's been pretty exciting, and for lack of better words, it's kind of going bananas lately. Last year it was in 278 schools. This year it's in 4,500 schools. And when I go to business schools, they ask me, you know, what's your marketing plan, or strategic plan? And I say, we don't have any. We just let the kids do it and take it on their own. So, but what's so exciting, though, is what kids end up doing in a few years. This young man, his name is Zachary. He's from Tampa, Florida. He's 11 years old. He did Pennies for Peace for a couple years. But a couple years ago, he saw some homeless kids in the Tampa area. So he decided to help, and he set up a foundation called Little Red Wagon Foundation. This year, he walked from Tampa to Washington, D.C., and he raised $74,000 to help homeless kids in the U.S. And next year, next summer, I'd like you to tune in to the Little Red Wagon Foundation. Zach is going to walk from Tampa to L.A. across the United States of America, and he plans to raise $1 million to help homeless kids here in the U.S. And when Zach set up his foundation, he called me up, and he wanted to know about board directors. You know, what's, you know, he had to get some adults, and are they like board people? Or, you know, I said, no, it's, you know, moral compass and fiduciary responsibility. And Zach said, could I put some kids on my board? I said, I don't think there's any law against it in Florida. So today, all of Zach's board directors have to be under 18 years of age to be on Little Red Wagon Foundation board. This is Anna Dodson from Colorado. She's was an orphan from Peru. She came to the U.S. when she was 3. She's now 16. She did Pennies for Peace for 3 years, but a couple years ago, she started an organization called Peruvian Hearts, and she and her fellow high school mates are helping 120 kids in an orphanage in Peru. And this young man, his name is Garrett Weiss. He's from Danville, California. He's 18 years old. He saw some kids in the Johannesburg in South Africa, and what bothered Garrett is that the kids had nowhere to play. So he started a foundation called fundafield.org, and last year he raised $58,000, and he started 5 soccer fields in the ghettos of Johannesburg. And next year he plans to build a dozen schools. He's been doing quite well. So, you know, the more I do this, I'm convinced that education must be our top priority, both nationally and internationally. In the world today, there are 120 million children who can't go to school, including 78 million females. You know, we can drop bombs, we can build roads, we can put in electricity, we can send in troops, we can put in computers, but unless girls are educated, a society will never change. So why is educating girls so important? There are three important reasons. Number one, reduce infant mortality. Number two, reduce the population explosion. And number two is quite significant. Bangladesh, the literacy rate there in 1970 was less than 20%. Today it's tripled. And if you look at a population graph in Bangladesh, it's just reaching an apex, 2.8 live births per female. 40 years ago, it was 8 births per female. And the single most important reason is simply female literacy. You know, you don't have to do anything controversial, nothing political. Female literacy is the number one way to control the population explosion. And number three, improve the quality of health and life itself. So now I've got some really bad news, and then I'll share with you some good news. And the bad news is the Taliban, in the last couple years, they bombed or destroyed over 850 schools in Afghanistan, over 600 schools in Pakistan. 90% of the schools, though, they're girls' schools. So why do a group of big bad men, you know, who have weapons, why are they so terrified of little girls going to school? Because I think their greatest fear, it's not a bullet, but it's a pen. And what they fear the most is if that girl gets an education, grows up, becomes a mother, the value of education goes on in the community. And they've lost their ideological way to control society. Now I've got some really good news. How many of you are aware of this fact, that in 2000, 9 years ago, there were 800,000 kids in school in Afghanistan. Today, there are 8.4 million children, including 2.5 million females. This is the greatest increase in school enrollment in any country in modern history. Now, I was briefing 5 U.S. senators about this in February. And afterwards, they're patting themselves on the back, and I said, how can you take credit for something you don't even know about? You know, that's a politician for you. Now, of course, we deserve some credit, but the real reason is because of the fierce tenacity and desire of people and women and mothers to help educate their children. That's really the real reason that the enrollment has gone up so much. Just keep going. And this is Admiral Mike Mullen. Can you go back one? He's the chairman, Joint Chief of Staff chairman. He invited me. He sent me a little letter last year and just said, he said, I hate to be forward with you, but would you mind coming to the Pentagon, having a cup of tea with me and telling me some good news? Because all I hear about is bad news, so I want you to share with me some good news. So I said, sure, I'd be honored to do that. I went to the Pentagon. We had a nice, long visit. We've gotten to grow pretty close since then. I also have tremendous respect for him, and he also asked me if he could come and visit a school in Afghanistan. I said, certainly, you know, if the elders want you there, well, come over and visit a school. So July 14th this year, we're a very remote valley in Pakistan, and all of a sudden over the horizon came 3 Black Hawk helicopters, and they landed out, jumped Admiral Mike Mullen, and he opened up a school. We had a wonderful visit. He gave a speech at the American Legion National Convention in Louisville, Kentucky on August 13th. And this is how he started out his speech. He said, historically, we, meaning the U.S., have been far too arrogant in the world. We need to go out and serve with humility. Historically, he said, the Muslim community is a subtle world we don't fully and don't always attempt to understand. Let me finish this and then I'll get done. Only through a shared appreciation of the people's culture, needs and hopes for the future, can we ourselves hope to supplant the extremist narrative. We cannot capture hearts and minds. We must engage them. We must listen to them, one heart, one mind at a time, over time. This is Admiral Mike Mullen. Okay. I ask... You know, I learned from my father and Haji Ali and General Petraeus, it's important to listen. So I ask women in Afghanistan or Pakistan, how can I help you and what would you like? You know, I want to help you, but what do you really want? And you'd think most women would say, I want a big house or a good husband or prosperity. But you know what most women tell me are just two simple things. We don't want our babies to die and we want our children to go to school. And on behalf of all those women, that's our plea and request. They don't want their babies to die, and they want their children to have that privilege and opportunity to go to school. And ultimately, I think that's the request of, you know, those of you who are mothers, that's really the request and desire of any mother, that you want the best for your children. So on behalf of those children, the women, that's their plea, is that we help them with education. So I'm going to wrap up here, and Laura, are you out there? Laura's coming out here. Pardon me? Oh, you want me to come off? Okay, all right. So anyways, I'll go off, and then we'll come back with Laura, and thank you very much.
Welcome, everyone. What a great, great night here in Portsmouth at the Music Hall. Thanks for being here. And Greg, thank you so much for being generous with your time.
Thank you, Laura.
We know you're a busy guy. We really appreciate it. Before we get into the book, which describes your efforts building schools in Afghanistan, you know, you write early on in this book, Greg, that Three Cups of Tea was just a phenomenon. I mean, the response from Americans was overwhelming. You said earlier people went bananas over this thing. Why do you think this work that you do has touched so many people in this country?
Well, Laura, I think one thing is I've had the blessing to visit hundreds of cities around the U.S., and everywhere I go, I find Americans were really good people. We're compassionate people. I think we're also very courageous people. But also, I think, you know, we've been living too much in fear, and I think we need to live in hope. And I'm also, you know, I'm very humbled by the fact that we have support from, you know, Republicans, Democrats, the U.S. military. Hundreds of servicemen and women are sending, you know, small donations in, and as a token of their appreciation. And they're also asking us that please do not give up your mandate or mission to help with education in Afghanistan. And I really think, education is something that can bring us together. And you know, unfortunately, in some other areas, we've become somewhat polarized politically or the debate over war. But education is something that can bring people together. And so it's been a great blessing to be able to meet people around the country and have that tremendous support.
You do write that after 9/11, you got some less than pleasant mail from people who were upset that you were helping to educate Muslims. Do you still get that?
We still have people that are not happy with what we're doing, but we also, I think it's important that people have can share their voice. I also have a pile of about 2,000 criticisms at home about Three Cups of Tea, but I actually went through them very carefully. And so in this book, Stones into Schools, we have a timeline, a glossary, who's who, more charts, more diagrams, more photos, more maps. And we also, and in the Young Readers version, we plan to have the children write more for the Young Readers version. So I'm trying very hard to listen to what people want, and I think it's very important that their voice be heard.
Well, Greg, and let's talk about this new book, again, Stones into Schools. And without giving away too much, tell us how you got involved in Afghanistan, because it's a great story right out of a movie.
The story, in Stones into Schools, it starts in 1999 when some horsemen, these are Kyrgyz horsemen, these are tribal horsemen from the northeast Afghanistan. They came over a mountain pass called their Shad Pass. They had heard about crazy Americans setting up schools in Pakistan, so they were sent by their, they were emissaries for Commander Abdul Rashid Khan, and they asked for help to build a school. They also asked me to spend the whole winter with them and hang out before we built a school, but I said, you know, I need to get home, but I promise to build a school. And it ended up taking 10 years to build a school for those people. And the reason why is that we had to build relationships all through this whole region. And but finally, this September, we were able to finish the school that we promised them back in 10 years ago.
And tell us about the guy who helped you build those relationships. You had your dirty dozen in Pakistan that helped you build schools there, but you needed in Afghanistan someone who really knew the territory, really knew the culture, really knew the many, many different peoples of Afghanistan. You needed, in short, an Afghan Indiana Jones. And you found him.
We found him. He's and I somewhat, the back of three cups of tea says, I'm Indiana Jones, and that's, you know, I've been trying to get that off the book for the last 4 years, but but we did find the real Indiana Jones. His name is Sofras Khan. He's our staff, about, we have 12 basic people. We also have about 900 teachers now, but they're half of them are pretty much illiterate. They come from various backgrounds. They've had very difficult lives, but they also, they're willing to devote their lives to education, also willing to risk their lives. We have some of our staff are working in very volatile, dangerous areas, but they're willing to do that on behalf of advocating for girls' education. And so Frost says he can ride a horse. He can. He has a mangled hand that he had shot at by the Indian Army. Used to be an ex-Pakistan commando, but he can hold a cell phone and smoke a cigarette and drive a car at the same time. And so we hired him.
Well, and he helped you really, really navigate what you call one of the most ethnically complicated countries on Earth. How did that ethnic and religious complexity make your job in Afghanistan, Greg, more complicated?
Well, it made it more complicated, but for me it also makes it much more fascinating. And I grew up with children from many different countries. In order to get schools built in Afghanistan, I also had to learn that Afghanistan is different than Pakistan in that it's more of what I call a warrior culture. They've been at war for 30 years. Also, historically, over the last two millennium, the Mongols, the Ottomans, Genghis Khan, the Greeks, the British, you know, on and on, armies would come into Afghanistan, and usually not do too well. So I wanted to kind of weave in the tapestry of all these different cultures and the traditional ways and the different ethnic groups. Also, by finally we're able to build the relationships, and we've had, this year has been our best year ever. We were able to set up the first girls' high schools in five new provinces in Afghanistan. And one story in particular is, it's fairly endearing, Uruzgan province is in the southern part of Afghanistan. It's the home of Mullah Omar, who's the leader of the Taliban. Our goal was in 20 years to put a girls' high school there. So this was a year ago, and this year, the Shura, these are the elders of the province, they heard about our attempt or our school building. They contacted me, and they said, could we come and visit one of your schools? I said, sure, you know, anytime, you're welcome. And so this summer, 14 men came from Uruzgan province. These are kind of scary-looking men. You know, they have black turbans and big beards, armed to the teeth. And they got to our school in Charsiav Valley. We have a giant playground in the school. And when they got to the school, the men saw the playground. They put down their weapons, and for the next hour and a half, they went on the swings and slides and just had a wonderful time. And then I said, you know, let's go have a meeting and kind of let's get serious here. You know, I got to look at the curriculum and go talk to the headmaster. And they said, no, we're totally satisfied. We want a girls' high school in Uruzgan province. So in September, I went to Tarankot, Uruzgan. We had a big jirga. It's like a tribal meeting. And they said, we're ready to build a school. We're ready to donate land, materials, free labor. And they broke ground a month ago on the school. But, of course, the first thing they're building in this school is a giant playground.
First things first.
And my only fear is that they're going to use it instead of the girls, so we're going to put a wall around it and make sure that the girls get to use it. You know, but in all seriousness, you know, when we think about two of those men, they never had a chance to play as a child, and they've been through atrocities, and some of them are, you know, kind of shady, I say 50-50 guys, but they're very committed now to getting that school set up in Uruzgan province.
So just clarify then, I remember two of your key workers, Safraz and Wakil, said, let's build a school in the heart of Taliban country, really command central. That's the school you're talking about, and it's being built right now?
It's already started.
It's already started.
It'll be done by next summer. And our staff, they're much more... they're willing to say we're going to go right into the heart of the Taliban. I try to be a little more diplomatic and say, you know, let's build relationships. But they're very keenly committed to making sure that every single girl in both Pakistan and Afghanistan has the chance to go to school.
Well, and how much has your work, Greg, been interrupted by the Taliban in the past year or two as we hear that they are resurgent in Afghanistan?
Well, they're obviously present. They are a threat. We've only had one school attacked by the Taliban, and that was only for a couple of days. But the primary reason the Taliban are not attacking our schools, at least I think so, is because when we set up a school, we provide the skilled labor, the materials, and then teacher training and teacher support, which I think is the most important thing. But the communities have to provide free land, free labor, free wood, and then free labor, 2 to 5,000 days of free manual labor. And what that does, Laura, is it ensures the local buy-in to get the communities to support the school. The one school that was attacked was in the Lander School in central Afghanistan. 2007, 14 Taliban came in at night. They beat up the night watchman quite horrifically. And then the next day they said, if any girl comes to school, we're gonna kill him. And the headmaster, he got on his bicycle. He pedaled about 23 miles. He went to the local militia leader. His name is Commandant Fahim. Now, he's kind of a shady guy, but he also has two daughters in school, not in our school, but another school. And so he rounded up 120 men called a Lashkar, which is like a vigilante or posse. He came in, he attacked the Taliban, he killed two of them, and then very quickly he extracted information from them. You know, you have to be careful how you say things. And they found out they got $3,000 from the local mullah to shut the school down. So now the mullah is in prison, three of the Taliban are in prison, and the Commandant Fahim has appointed 12 askar, these are local militia, to guard the school 24/7. And their orders are, if anybody harms any girl or any teacher coming to school, just shoot them. Now, that's not how I'd like to run a school, but that's how they run their school, and that's quite fine with me. And they never come back.
Well, and Greg, you know, on a serious note, why do you think the Taliban are resurgent in Afghanistan? Because everyone you seem to work with in this book doesn't want them around. So who's supporting them?
Well, the Taliban have changed somewhat over. They first entered they kind of started out about 94. Many of the Taliban originally were from Afghan refugee camps, mostly Pashtun, tribal people. They also, Deobandi, that's kind of the persuasion of the ideology they adhere to. They came from the Taliban, though, today are more what I call, they're kind of more mafia style. The Taliban have become more criminal, much more violent. They're getting funding from illicit lumber trafficking, from kidnapping, from heroin trafficking, from, you know, criminals activity. And it was interesting, I went to Camp Lejeune 3 months ago. I was briefing 2,000 U.S. Marines who are going to Afghanistan, and they told me that some of the Marines now, before they go to Afghanistan, they go to L.A. and they embed with gangs for a month before they go to Afghanistan because it's more of a kind of mafia gang style. And the Taliban really are not that a monolithic kind of ideological kind of entity we're thinking about. They're much more, they're very fractured. There are many different conflicting groups, and they've gotten more violent. But on the other hand, they've kind of overstepped their welcome with people. Most people really do not like the Taliban. They even loathe Al-Qaeda more than that. There's a saying that you can rent an Afghan, but you can't buy an Afghan. What that means is, you know, you can, if you have money, you can maybe help, you know, you can work with people for a while, but ultimately you can't really help them, you know, with their health care and education. So it's going to be a long road ahead, but there has been quite a significant change in the general populace, especially in Pakistan, who are really starting now to turn against the Taliban because they become so violent, and they say even what they're doing is not in the name of Islam.
I want to ask you another question from the book. There are a lot of really great success stories, but some setbacks. There's a story in the book about a girl whose family denies her the chance to go on to higher education because her brother-in-law, not even her brother or her father, her brother-in-law is jealous, and he figures, well, if I can't have the scholarship, neither can she. How often do you run into these types of family problems that prohibit girls from accessing one of your schools?
Well, Lord, it happens a lot. That young woman named is Gozia. There's hundreds of girls who we meet or who we hear about who are denied the opportunity to go to school. There's been a lot of violence directed against girls going to school. In Kandahar last November, 14 girls were headed to high school in Mirvais High School. They were just walking to school, and the Taliban sprayed battery acid on their faces. And some of these young women got severe burns. Some of them are blind. But they all came back to school, though, this March, and they celebrated. And they said, the only way the Taliban can stop us is they're going to have to kill us. Now, that's a very extreme example, but that's what I find everywhere, that there's a fierce desire to have an education. And also, when someone goes on jihad, and jihad means a quest or struggle, they really should get permission from their mother first. And I found that when women have an education, they're much less likely to condone their son to get into violence or into terrorism. Even after 9/11, the Taliban were going around to get recruits, but they're primarily targeting illiterate, impoverished society because many educated women, even at threat of their lives, they refuse to allow their sons to join the Taliban.
Well, I want to share you now with the audience. We have some great questions here, okay. Greg. And here's one. What was the biggest contributing factor that made these people trust you in a part of the world that is not very trusting of us?
I think it's kind of pretty much universal, but I think ultimately really what connects people is having respect, having dignity for people, acting out of love and compassion. And I think something else that really we're able to get trust from the people is because we empower people. And that's we don't try to go do anything on their own. It's kind of what my father really taught me, is that you're only there to help the people themselves and help them empower people. And when people are empowered, they're willing really to do anything. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of risks, there's some danger, but we also have incredible support from the communities, and they're willing to do pretty much anything. And I also, when I talk to the military or to aid groups, I say it's very important that you first put the elders back in charge. And that's one of the things the Taliban are doing very deliberately, is they're trying to destroy the relationship between the elders and the youth and drive a wedge through society. And as I mentioned before, here in the U.S., we have a very, you know, it's unfortunate we've kind of lost that tradition, but that's what really binds society together. And so if you go into a region, you tell the elders you're in charge, you also listen to them and work with them, you can really gain their trust. The U.S., the military has deployed over the last 3 years many troops in the forward operating base. These are very remote posts and isolated areas of a company or a platoon of men or a couple of women. You know, there's a few women out there. And their primary mandate is that they have to build relationships with those communities. And if you go to the central command room, the forward operating base, if you went there 3 years ago, you'd see a grid, and it would have, you know, it'd say we have 120 men and 50 machine guns and you know, 100 grenades or whatever. But today you'll see on the grid a chart, and it has who's the head, the tribal leaders, the militia leaders, the religious leaders, and their primary mandate is you need to go out and build relationships, and those relationships are very enduring, and they're very powerful. And I can't say enough how important it is that we work with the elders in a country like Afghanistan.
I get a message from your book that when it comes to building the schools, it seems as if the empowerment that the local people get in building this thing, completing the project, seeing it flourish, is really just as much the story of what you're trying to do as getting kids a basic education.
I think so, and that was, you know, in the news is a lot of talk about the number of troops in Afghanistan, and our president spent many months deliberating about it. What bothered me about that was the fact that these deliberations, I think there was 9 meetings or 10 meetings, but they were held in secrecy and privacy. There was no testimony on Capitol Hill. The public, the media wasn't allowed in these meetings. And the thing that concerned me is that there was also no involvement of the Afghan, the Shura. You know, we didn't ask the tribal leaders over there, what do you want? You know, what do you think about more troops? And I've spent a lot of time talking to them. I've also helped facilitate dozens of meetings between the U.S. military and many of the elders, the Shura, in Afghanistan. And we do this all, you know, without any compensation. We just do it to help the elders out. And the things that they say are, we need some help. We like troops over here, but we want the trainer troops. We don't need firepower, we need brain power. And I think what it's important in the American public too, and for all of you, is that out of the 22,000 troops that we deployed this year in Afghanistan, about 8,000 of those are trainer troops. Many of them are from the National Guard, they're reservists, they're veterinarians, they're physicians, they're nurses, they're horticulturalists, agronomists, hydrologists, and they're trying to help with work with the people. Out of the 30,000 troops that are being deployed, I think 8 or 10,000 of those troops, again, are trainer troops, and they are making a big difference there. And a lot of the big aid groups get pretty upset, and they complain, you know, how come the Department of Defense is getting all this money, and we should get the money. And also, you know, make clear here, we have never received a dime of federal money, and we never will take a dime of federal money, but because we have such great support from people. But it's very difficult for the U.S. military now because they have to wear 3 caps. They have to be a diplomat, a humanitarian, and a warrior. And it's a virtually impossible task, but they've been given that assignment. And I've read some columnists say we need to send over legions of Birkenstock warriors to Afghanistan. But the problem is, even if we ask for those, you'd only get a few crazy people like me to sign up. So,
well, Greg, I have 3 or 4 or 5 cards all on that same question, wanting to know how you feel about the surge of 30,000 troops to Afghanistan.
Well, my feelings are pretty much based on, you know, I'd say it's important to how do the elders feel in Afghanistan, the Shura. And as I mentioned before, they are appreciative of the help, but they also say, you know, we don't really need a lot more troops here, you know, firepower. We need brain power. We need troops to help our troops. And it's also, I find, you know, there's been a lot of wonderful things happening in Afghanistan over the last, since 9/11. The number of kids in school, I mentioned, has gone from 800,000 to 8.5 million. The goal is 13 million. So we're about 60% of the way there. There's 80,000 trained troops there now, the Afghan National Army. The goal is 180,000. So that's about 40% of the way there. There's a central banking system since 2006, which has been a huge help. If you go into the district courts, you'll find that the number of women and men, but especially women, filing titles and deeds for land ownership is skyrocketing. And, you know, I think the U.S., we're too busy trying to plug in democracy around the world, but you can't plug in democracy, you have to build democracy. And I think it starts with education, also land ownership. So if you weigh all of us in, we're quite, I mean the Afghan people and us, they're about 60% of the way where they could really get on their own feet. And I think the extra troops may help a little bit. It's also going to escalate the problem. And unfortunately, the other thing that's going to happen is the casualties are going to go way up. There's going to be, you know, it's inevitable, and I know it's going to happen. Many more troops are going to get killed, and the American public is going to have to decide whether we want to take that risk and that price. And war is the ultimate decision a country has to make, and it's a very difficult decision. But I do think we absolutely have to involve the elders of the country in Afghanistan to help us, and we can help them.
Here's one I really want to share with you. Dear Greg, I just received my commission as an Army officer and will be deployed to Afghanistan. As I have built schools in Southeast Asia, I fully understand the impact of such projects. How can I, an Army officer in Afghanistan, support and facilitate similar projects? Thank you.
Well, thanks. I don't know if it's a gentleman or a
Adam.
Woman.
His name's Adam, yeah.
Adam, okay, sir. Thanks, sir. Well, I appreciate, first, your service. I'd like to tell you first that we have tremendous leaders in the U.S. military. I didn't get to share with you some other examples, but we have now, I think there's been a huge learning curve in the U.S. military. I've also met hundreds of military officers working in Afghanistan who are helping with the people. And I also, having talked to General Petraeus, Admiral Mullen, Admiral Olson, who's the Special Forces Commander, and many other military leaders, they will all tell you, even General Conway, who's the Marine Corps Commandant, they will all tell you point blank, there is no military solution in this country. This has got to be a much broader solution. And they will also tell you that education is a key to that. I think, you know, I'd tell you that you go over there, you're going to find some officers who are helping out, and just join in and work with them.
Here's another question. This person says, thank you for doing this work. What is the most profound life lesson you have learned from your experiences thus far, or the most surprising?
The most important life lesson?
Or the most surprising?
Well, maybe it's the first word of the first chapter of Three Cups of Tea about failure. In one of the areas we work in Baltistan and northern Pakistan, the Balti language, it has no word that means failure. And I thought that's rather interesting. You know, we flunk, we fail, we bomb out, we burn out, we have all kinds of words to fail, but they don't even have a word for failure. If the word they use for failure is really, it's kind of like a transition, I guess is the word that define it. And I would say the biggest lessons I've learned that I can learn from my failures and mistakes, and I feel very blessed that I've made a lot of mistakes, but I try to learn from my mistakes.
Well, there are several times in this book, Stones into Schools, where you describe feeling powerless and you can't do the things you want to do, either to your own health or to situations that just come up. I won't give them away here. And yet, similar to when you couldn't quite get to the top of K2, these failures of yours kind of turn into their own blessings.
Well, life is, you'd like life to be wonderful and work out, and, you know, the Three Cups of Tea and Stones into School, they're nonfiction, they're real stories, and life is kind of messy sometimes, and, you know, I wish I would have known what I know now when I started out, but I didn't know about that, but I really have enjoyed. I have a quote on my bathroom mirror, and I've had it there for 20 years, and it says, when your heart speaks, take good notes. And it's by Judith Campbell, and I look at that every morning when I'm home, and I think it's very important too that we also work more with our intuition. It's one thing also that I think the kids in Afghanistan and Pakistan, they might not be literate, they might not have as much technology, but they're very intuitive, and I think that comes from growing up without being able to control everything in their lives. You know, whether it's poverty or you know, they're not able to have the alarms or open up the door or say the refrigerator or car keys or, you know, everything we turn and off and on here. So we're very much in control of our environment. But what that does help is I think it develops a more intuitive sense. And I think that's one reason I also really encourage kids here in the U.S. to spend more time outdoors and go for hikes, and encourage kids to spend time with their families. And another thing that I really think that we absolutely need to do in this country is that every single child should be bilingual. And it doesn't matter what language. It can be Spanish or French. But our kids who were illiterate, by fifth grade, they learned five languages.
Your two kids.
No, in our schools.
Oh, in the schools. Because you have
languages.
Two children, too.
Yeah, my kids, they speak Spanish and English, but a little Urdu. But I think that's really, it's not what language you learn, but that we understand that we're part of a global community.
In the book, pretty late on, you talk about how the endless salesmanship and fundraising and doing interviews like this one for the cause of building schools in Afghanistan it really started to wear on you. You know, you weren't back where your heart was. You were here doing endless events. And it got to the point, Greg, where you write that you started collapsing. How are you trying to work this out to the point where you're still working for the cause, you're still raising the money, but you're not collapsing, which in the end doesn't help anybody?
Well, I wasn't made to be doing this. You know, I'm kind of a shy guy, I'm a reserved guy, and I'd much rather be obviously way in the back there behind these dark lights without being up here. But I'm also very passionate about education. And really, again, my wife is the real angel and saint in my life. She sat me down several times. She sat me down after three cups of tea, and she said, okay, now that you've got a book done, you really need to start taking care of yourself. And I did make some changes, but probably not enough. And again, you know, but I did hire a director. We hired a CPA auditor to go through all our books. We hired an attorney to kind of get everything organized. And we've hired some wonderful staff overseas, local people. But what really inspires me is to be able to talk with children and students around the country. And there's kind of a phenomenon going on. I'm not sure how many are aware of this, but there was a U.S. News and World Report that came out 2 years ago. It said that in 1970, about 30% of college graduates said, I want to go out and make my community or my country or the international community a better place. By 1990, 20 years later, it dropped to 18%. That was the day everybody wanted to go out and make a buck. But today, 50% of college graduates say, I want to go out and make my community or the world a better place. And if you go into high schools, it's even higher. Part of the reason for that, it's obviously some innovative leadership, but the real reason is being driven by the students themselves. All college presidents will tell you that. And to me, it's very inspiring. I mentioned the examples of kids. And so when I get a little bit overwhelmed or frustrated, that's why I go to lots of schools, because that's what really kind of plugs me in and helps me get more, you know, say, not motivated, but I'm really inspired by children.
Well, in the book, you really show us how your Afghan employees, especially Safraz and Wakil, they really start to take on projects themselves, sometimes even acting outside of your authority. How did it feel, Greg, you know, as someone who loves to be there, loves to be on the ground, loves the environment there, loves the people, how did it feel to kind of have to let them take it over?
Well, actually, it feels great. I should have done it 10 years ago. What's most exciting is when you let go and let women take charge. You know, I've got four women who basically control my life now. But in Afghanistan, we spent 6 years setting up 17 women's literacy centers. Now, these centers are where women who are older or married or have kids, they learn how to read and write. They also learn hygiene, sanitation, nutrition. They learn about money. We also give them cell phones. And, you know, you better look out when women start communicating with each other. But anyways, this summer, I told the women, why don't you set up your own co-op? You know, you do this yourself. So they called me up. I just got a couple weeks ago. Now they have 108 women's literacy centers just in the last like 3 or 4 months. And so then I told them, you know, now set up your nonprofit. So I think next year there's going to be 1,000 Women's Literacy Center. But, you know, when I finally let go, that's when things really happened. And I wish I would have done that a long time ago.
Last question, and you can make it short if you want. Who would you really like to share 3 cups of tea with as kind of a crowning achievement for this Afghanistan effort?
You mean the book or the...
Just who would you like to have
those...
drink
3 cups of tea?
Yeah. No, not the book, 3 cups of tea.
Oh.
Who would you like to sit down and have 3 cups of tea with?
Well, I'd like to have 3 cups of tea with everybody here. definitely. That's probably a little the frustrating part about it, because I'm able to go to visit lots of communities, but I really love the one-to-one and really sitting down and having a cup of tea with people. And I don't drink coffee, I don't drink any alcohol, but I do drink tea. And I'd really hope that all of us here, that we could have tea with the people over there. The Americans were such good people. The people over there are such good people. 95% of the people over there are really good people, or maybe 99%. And I think, you know, we fight about our 5% of differences, but mostly we're all very similar. We have the same fears and hopes and desires and dreams, and hopefully that General Petraeus was rather kind of interesting. He was on National Public Radio at an international defense summit in Berlin. I think it was in February this year. And so a very serious correspondent on NPR, I don't know who it was, but they asked him, so what do you think should be our top priority in Afghanistan? And without missing a heartbeat, General Petraeus said, we need to go over there and drink more tea with the locals. And the correspondent, you know, being very serious, like, no, what you mean, like, it's on tape on the digital file. So he said, no, we need to go over there and drink more tea and get to know the locals. But I really think that's a key, is not drinking tea, but building relationships.
Writers on a New England Stage is a collaboration between the Music Hall and New Hampshire Public Radio, in collaboration also with River Run Books. The executive producer and live stage presentation director is Patricia Lynch. The New Hampshire Public Radio president is Betsy Gardella. The New Hampshire Public Radio broadcast producer is Keith Shields. The associate producer is Tom Holbrook from River Run Bookstore. The associate producer and director of strategic communications is Margaret Talcott. The live sound engineer is Eric Reuter. Recording and mixing engineer is Mike Marchand. The musical director and the band is Bob Lord and Dreadnought. Thanks again to our guest tonight, Greg Mortensen. Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah.